except just to fix myself through the music. When I finished the program, they give me a hug, and I become very emotional.
And in Maine, Abdulie's music finds Somali and Somali-American audiences who connect with his lyrics and message.
But life can't take you everywhere in this world. And wherever you go and place that you find peace is home. I don't know how to say this, but without music, I don't know how my life will be like.
For the world, I'm Caroline Losnick in Maine. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the United States Japan Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Amy Rao and Harry Plant, Roman Mars, Dan Kletter, Ashton Peary and Catherine Wolfe, Beverly and Don Freeman, and Carolyn Talcott. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
Stay with us. The PBS NewsHour is up next. Julie Depesch is stepping in, though, for some traffic information. We're off to the South Bay. Hi, Julie.
Yeah, we're just getting word of a three-vehicle wreck. Eastbound 237 is Zanker Road. They say the off-ramp is blocked here. That's a major backup, though, to Great America Parkway. Car fire on the Altamont East 580 before the Stonecut overpass takes up the two right lanes. We've got a wreck in San Francisco, northbound 101 before Cesar Chavez. Couple cars, two left lanes are blocked here. Traffic stopped back to 280. Julie Depesch for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. KQED Live presents a night of contemporary jazz music and a look at the local scene live on stage with the podcast Right Now-ish, June 20th at 7 p.m. Tickets at kqed.org/live, supported by Berkeley Rep. KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highlands, it's 3 o'clock.
Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, Claudia Sheinbaum becomes the first woman to win Mexico's presidential election. What that means for U.S. relations.
A jury is selected in Delaware in the federal gun trial of President Biden's son, Hunter.
And Dr. Anthony Fauci is grilled by House Republicans over the origins of and his response to COVID-19.
I don't think the concept of there being a lab leak is inherently a conspiracy theory.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by the ongoing support of these individuals and institutions, and friends of the NewsHour, including Leonard and Norma Klorfine and the Judy and Peter Bloom Kovler Foundation.
Two retiring executives turn their focus to Greyhounds, giving these former race dogs a real chance to win. A Raymond James financial advisor gets to know you, your purpose, and the way you give back. Life well planned.
The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. For more than 50 years, advancing ideas and supporting institutions to promote a better world at Hewlett.org. And with the ongoing support of these individuals and institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Israel has confirmed the death of four more hostages that were taken by Hamas on October 7th.
Israel's military says the men were killed in the Gaza city of Khan Yunis while its forces were operating there earlier this year. They've been identified as Amram Cooper, Yoram Metzger, Haim Perry, and Nadav Popowell. Three of them had appeared in a hostage video last December pleading for their release.
The cause of death is still under investigation, and it comes as mediators wait for word from Hamas on a three-phase ceasefire proposal announced by President Biden on Friday. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said today the ball is in Hamas's court.
If you look at the major elements of this proposal, they are nearly identical to the major elements of the proposal that Hamas submitted several weeks ago. This is a serious enough proposal that Hamas should just accept it, but if there need to be further negotiations, we think those are all imminently bridgeable. If Hamas wants a deal.
In the meantime, in central Gaza, families mourned the deaths of 11 people who were killed overnight in two separate Israeli airstrikes on refugee camps. Three children were reportedly among the dead. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky made a surprise visit to the Philippines today as part of a rare trip to Asia. He's trying to drum up support for an upcoming peace conference on the war in Ukraine, scheduled for mid-June in Switzerland. Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. rolled out the red carpet for Zelensky and pledged to join the summit. Zelensky announced that Ukraine would open an embassy in Manila, deepening ties between the countries.
We are very thankful to be in your country and which supports Ukraine, our territorial integrity and sovereignty. Thank you so much for your big word and clear position about us, about this Russian occupation of our territories.
Russia has not been invited to the Switzerland summit, and China says it won't attend either. Vice President Kamala Harris will represent the United States. President Biden is expected to issue an executive order tomorrow that would significantly limit the entry of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. The NewsHour has learned that the order would shut down asylum requests when the number of daily encounters between ports of entry reaches 2,500. The border would then reopen only when that number falls to 1,500. This effectively means that the border would be closed immediately, as current levels are above 2,500. Biden is expected to announce the measure at the White House on Tuesday. He'll be joined by mayors of border cities who've been invited for the event. A Georgia appeals court has set October 4th as the tentative date for a hearing on efforts to remove Fani Willis from Donald Trump's Georgia election case. The Fulton County District Attorney was allowed to stay on the case in March after admitting to a romantic relationship with a special prosecutor she'd hired. Trump lawyers have appealed that decision. The timing of the hearing means that Trump won't face trial in Georgia before the November election. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has announced that she has pancreatic cancer. The Texas Democrat acknowledged in a statement that the, quote, road ahead will not be easy. But she added, quote, I'm confident that my doctors have developed the best possible plan to target my specific disease. The 74-year-old says she may miss some time in Congress while getting treatment, but aims to be present for votes. Jackson Lee is seeking a 16th term in Congress. Firefighters in California are reining in the state's largest wildfire of the year so far, now containing 75% of the blaze. Over the weekend, the Corral Fire burned more than 22 square miles between San Francisco Bay and the Central Valley. Thousands were ordered to evacuate, though they have since been allowed to return home. One house was destroyed and two people were injured. Firefighters hope to make more progress before a heat wave is expected to arrive tomorrow. Toyota's chairman has apologized for widespread cheating on vehicle certification tests. An internal investigation ordered by Japan's government found that the company manipulated data in collision tests, airbag inflation tests, and more. The automaker is suspending production of three of the affected models. That's the Corolla Fielder, the Corolla Axio, and the Yaris Cross. The company says that the findings do not affect the safety of vehicles already on the road. At a press conference today, Toyota's chairman acknowledged that the correct certification process had not been followed.
As the person responsible for the Toyota Group, I would like to sincerely apologize to our customers, car enthusiasts, and all stakeholders for the problems that have occurred within the group. I am truly sorry.
Toyota's rival, Mazda, reported similar irregularities with its testing today and suspended production of two of its models. CEOs at the largest publicly traded companies in the U.S. saw a healthy bump in pay raise last year. That's according to data analyzed for the Associated Press. The results found that the median pay package for CEOs rose to $16.3 million in 2023. That is a 12.6% gain from the year before. And it's far more than the average private sector worker, who saw a 4.1% bump. One additional note from the survey: of the 341 CEOs surveyed, only 25 were women. And on Wall Street today, stocks ended mixed after a report showed that U.S. manufacturing activity slowed for the second straight month in May. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 115 points to close at 38,571. The Nasdaq gained 93 points, and the S&P 500 tacked on 5. And the long-abandoned Michigan Central train station in Detroit has been given a new life. The building fell into disrepair after the last train pulled out in 1988. Many saw it as a symbol of the Motor City's decline. Today, it has been reborn thanks to a six-year, multi-million dollar renovation. But instead of trains, the building will be a center for technology as part of Ford Motor's new Mobility Innovation District. Still to come on the NewsHour, Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political headlines. A new exhibit chronicles the prolific career of artist Michael Lindsay Hogg. And a first-of-its-kind medical school for Native American doctors graduates its inaugural class.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Mexico made history yesterday, electing its first female president and first president of Jewish heritage. Claudia Sheinbaum won in a landslide with more than 58% of the vote. She will face many challenges as president, including security, organized crime, immigration, and the continuing, at times tense, relationship with the U.S. Pamela Starr is a professor at the University of Southern California and a senior advisor at Monarch Global Strategies. That's a business consultancy focused on Mexico and Latin America. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
So how do you view the significance of this moment, Mexico electing its first female president?
I think it's enormously significant, especially for young women who are of Mexican heritage or are living in Mexico. It's extraordinarily important to see someone in a position of importance that is of the same gender of you. But at the same time, I don't suspect that Claudia Sheinbaum will be a feminist president, although she does self-identify as a feminist. She's a traditional leftist, and by that I mean she focuses on lifting up all of those who are in the lower socioeconomic strata and not focusing on individual minorities in society, or in this case, women who are the largest majority in Mexico, the largest segment of the population. I do, however, think she's going to put a little more attention into violence against women, which López Obrador didn't, the former president didn't give much attention to, and potentially to things like daycare and such.
Well, as we said, she won with a sweeping mandate, more than 58% of the vote. Why was she so successful? What was it about her, her background, her overall approach that seemed to resonate with the Mexican voting public?
More than her, it's what she stands for. She was chosen by López Obrador, handpicked to be his successor. The campaign was run as a continuation of López Obrador's presidency. As she said, she's going to build the second level on the transformation of Mexico that López Obrador initiated. So it wasn't so much a vote for Claudia Sheinbaum as a vote for continuity in Mexican politics.
Let's return to the issue of violence, because these elections in Mexico have been historic for another reason. They've been the most violent. In the run-up to the elections, more than 30 candidates were assassinated. Mexico has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. What is she aiming to do to address it?
Her overall proposal is try to adapt the strategies she implemented in Mexico City, which did significantly reduce crime and violence in the city, to a national situation. situation. In Mexico City, she increased the wages and working conditions for the police. She used greater intelligence in police activities, and she very carefully collaborated or guaranteed collaboration between law enforcement and the Attorney General's office. She'll try to do something similar at the federal level. That said, she's not going to return to civilian policing with regard to federal criminal problems like organized crime. She's going to rely on the militarized National Guard, although she is going to try to expand its size, increase working conditions and wages, and increase their use of intelligence and collaboration with the Attorney General's office.
What about immigration, which is a major issue in this election? How does she plan to coordinate with the U.S., and has she articulated a plan for how to deal with the migrants who make their way through Mexico toward the U.S.?
She didn't talk about much about foreign policy in the campaign. Indeed, there was a debate segment that was focused on foreign policy, and really none of the candidates spoke a great deal about foreign policy. In terms of migration, I suspect she'll continue López Obrador's strategy of trying to cooperate with the United States while protecting Mexican sovereignty, knowing that cooperating with the United States generates the goodwill of the U.S. administration and gives Mexico more freedom of action on areas of greater importance to Mexico, like domestic politics.
Pamela Starr, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your insights.
It was my pleasure.
For the first time in U.S. history, the child of a sitting president is on trial. President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, is facing federal charges related to his purchase and possession of a gun. Separately, Hunter Biden faces several charges that he allegedly dodged more than $1.4 million in taxes. The president did not attend court where jury selection began today, but he did issue this statement, saying, "I am the president, but I'm also a dad. Jill and I love our son, and we're so proud of the man he is today. Hunter's resilience in the face of adversity and the strength he's brought to his recovery are inspiring to us." NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas was in the Wilmington, Delaware courtroom today, and he joins us now. Ryan, it's good to see you. So let's just remind folks about the charges here. Anyone using drugs or struggling with addiction is barred from buying or owning a gun. Hunter Biden denied that he was a, quote, unlawful user or addict on his application to buy a gun back in 2018, that he's been open about his addiction struggles at that time. So is this sort of an open and shut case?
Well, certainly the government thinks that it's an open and shut case. They say that Hunter Biden, when he went to purchase a gun in October of 2018, was addicted to crack cocaine and alcohol, and that he lied about that on standard background check forms that you have to fill out when you purchase a gun. So in the government's perspective, this is very much an open and shut case. Now, Hunter's attorneys certainly feel that it is not an open and shut case. For them, they say that this is far more complicated. They say, have said in filings at least, that Hunter had completed an 11-day rehab program around the time that this all went down. So they say that it is logical from his perspective that perhaps he didn't understand what a drug addict or drug user meant on that form, and that he could think that he was not using drugs at that time. Judge Mary Ellen Nareka has kind of boxed that argument in to a degree by saying that federal prosecutors do not need to prove that Hunter Biden was actively using drugs when he was purchasing the gun. But again, this is very much something that's going to be up to the jury to decide based on the evidence that the government presents in the case.
So as we mentioned, jury selection began and ended today. Tell us what we should know about that jury and what stood out to you about the selection process.
Well, the process moved very quickly. It was actually less than a full day, and the judge was able to impanel this jury of 12 jurors, four alternates. It is an even mix, six men, six women. It's a majority black jury. What was really interesting over the course of the jury selection process was one that several of the potential jurors said that Wilmington and Delaware generally is a small place. There were several folks who had known the Biden family, whether it be Joe Biden, Jill Biden, or Hunter himself, or his late brother. And there was also the issue of a lot of potential jurors had family or friends who had struggled with addiction. There was one potential juror who said they had a friend who died of a heroin overdose. So this is some of the issues that are very much central to this case are things that people in the community know and have experienced. That said, the judge and both sides were able to whittle this jury pool down. And all the jurors who ended up being impaneled were individuals who said that they could set aside their personal experiences as well as their knowledge of the case and judge it based on the facts and the evidence as they're presented in the courtroom.
So Ryan, walk us through the timeline ahead now. What do we expect to happen next? And also, what possible penalty could Hunter Biden face here if convicted?
Well, we will have opening statements tomorrow morning from both sides. Then I believe that the government will call its first witness, which is expected to be an FBI agent who worked on this investigation into Hunter Biden. As for penalties, in theory, up to 25 years is the maximum sentence for Hunter Biden in this case. There are two charges that carry a maximum of 10 years and one charge that carries a five-year maximum sentence. That said, Hunter Biden has no known criminal history. He's a first-time offender. So that maximum sentence is most likely not what he would end up being seeing. The sentencing guidelines would be much lower. And ultimately, it's going to be up to the judge to decide if he is convicted, what the sentence would be.
In the 30 seconds or so I have left, do we expect Hunter Biden himself or any Biden to take the stand?
There's no word on whether Hunter Biden himself would testify, but prosecutors have said that they do expect to call Hunter Biden's ex-wife, Catherine Buell, as well as Beau's widow, Hallie Biden, who Hunter Biden was involved with romantically at the time that this all went down in 2018. So this is a case that is going to dig up some dark parts of Hunter Biden's life, his struggles with addiction, and certainly how that affected the Biden family.
That is NPR's justice correspondent Ryan Lucas joining us from Delaware tonight. Ryan, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
The 2024 presidential election is now in unknown territory, with Donald Trump, the first former American president and first major party presumptive nominee, found guilty of a felony. Our Lisa Desjardins takes a closer look at the reaction in recent days. 45.
The visuals certainly were clear. Saturday in New Jersey, former President Donald Trump strode into a match for the Ultimate Fighting Championship, watching mixed martial arts, a combat sport known for muscle and bloodshed. This was his first public appearance after being found guilty of nearly three dozen felonies. The crowd whooped it up, but from Trump, the signal was serious and provocative. Then in a weekend interview with Fox and Friends,
you know, my revenge will be success, and I mean that. But it's awfully hard when you see what they've done. These people are so evil.
He lit another match over his upcoming sentencing.
The judge could decide to say, hey, house arrest or even jail.
It could.
Face
it could.
What that could
be. I'm okay with it.
But he warned,
I think it would be tough for the public to take. You know, at a certain point, there's a breaking point.
It was not his only warning shot. Trump also said this about top Pentagon generals.
They want there to be woke, but these guys aren't meant for woke. I would fire them. You can't have woke military.
As Trump takes swings, his supporters are showering him with big dollars. $70 million fundraised in the 48 hours after last week's verdict, according to the Republican National Committee. Republicans in Congress now, or who hope to be, also seem eager to show allegiance and win base points for themselves. In a letter, eight Senate Republicans vowed to block major bills and President Biden's nominees, saying, quote, we are unwilling to aid and abet this White House in its project to tear this country apart. In Montana,
it's Lawfare, a state-sponsored political persecution led by Joe Biden and the radical left. They want to throw Trump in jail.
In a key U.S. Senate race, the first ad about the conviction from Republican hopeful Tim Sheehy, who repeated Trump's charges and lack of direct proof that his conviction was unfair. But the question is still about Donald Trump, with events in Phoenix and Las Vegas later this week, and which punches he throws next. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
For analysis of the political fallout to the Trump verdict and more, we're joined by our Politics Monday duo. That's Tamara Keith of NPR and Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter.
Great to see you both, as always. So we've just seen the Republican strategy for dealing with Donald Trump's guilty conviction. Discredit the process, discredit the outcome. But Tam, there seems to be something of a tactical disagreement among Democrats over just how much to lean in and how much to use this as a political cudgel. Take us inside the thinking among the party.
Yeah, so I have spoken to people on the Biden campaign, and they are in the camp of don't lean in too far. As in, this is not their whole campaign. Donald Trump, convicted felon, is not going to solve all of their problems. They still need to run a campaign. And the way they see it is this is one of the proof points in the case that they intend to make why Biden should be elected and Trump should not be elected. But they don't see it as the key to their case. And I think, you know, based on very early polling and everything else, there's a reason it shouldn't be the key to their case. And they know that they have a lot of work. This is going to be a very close campaign. And it turns out that having a conviction is not a game changer.
And Amy, well, here's how at least one Democrat, Congressman Adam Schiff, who served as an impeachment manager, a House impeachment manager, here's how he sees the potential impact of all this.
This is another dangerous appeal to violence. And it is yet another reason why Americans are going to decide they don't want a convicted felon in the Oval Office. They don't want someone that has so little respect for the system of justice or our criminal laws that they're a convicted felon and then attack the system as a result.
So with the caveat that it's still early days, yeah, how do you see this conviction shaking the dynamic, if at all, of the 2024 race?
So I'm with Tam that the polls aren't really telling us all that much right now, in part because they were taken immediately afterward, and I think that folks still hadn't really processed that yet. But also because the election isn't in May. It's in November, and I think if you look at who the undecided voters are in this election, many of them are people who dislike both of these candidates equally. And they are going to make their choice about whether to vote at all or which candidate to vote for probably as we get into September and October. And where the focus, where the spotlight is in September and October is going to matter a lot more. We also have some other cases that have yet to be delivered. Obviously, the Supreme Court's decision on whether President Trump can claim presidential immunity. I think that has that could have an impact as well. That's any day now. We could see that case coming down. Fundamentally, though, what Democrats do believe is that the focus less on maybe the case and the convicted felon piece, more on this idea that Trump is going to come back looking for retribution, looking to foment violence, connecting it to a lot of the things that were helpful to Democrats in 2022, especially when they talked about January 6th and people who were election deniers or who said that if the elections don't go the way we want, we're going to overturn them.
And Tam, the level of support for Donald Trump is so intense among Republicans right now that Larry Hogan, the former Maryland governor who is running now for Maryland's open Senate seat, said that the American people should respect the verdict, and that was enough for fellow Republicans to jump all over him, including Laura Trump, the president's daughter-in-law, who is a co-chair of the RNC. Here's what she had to say when asked about it.
We, of course, want to win as a party, but that is a shame, and I think he should have thought long and hard before he said that publicly. He doesn't deserve the respect of anyone in the Republican Party at this point, and quite frankly, anybody in America.
The co-chair of the RNC saying that Larry Hogan, one of their candidates, doesn't deserve the respect of anybody in this country?
One of their prime recruits, their best hope to win in a blue state, and now the chairman of the president's campaign, the former president's campaign, is saying that his campaign has ended because he said respect the process. Because it turns out saying respect the process is the same as betraying Trump, because the Republicans very quickly and basically before the verdict even came in, settled on the narrative. And the narrative is that the process wasn't fair, that this was a political railroading. And because they settled on the process isn't fair, if someone comes out and says, oh, respect the process, well, then you're saying that maybe Trump deserved to be convicted.
I'd argue that might be an in-kind contribution, actually, to the Larry Hogan campaign. If I were him, I would run that ad. Yeah. He's running in Maryland, a state that Trump lost by more than 30 points. And he has been very outspoken in his time as governor as sort of a voice against Donald Trump. But this is the kind of messaging that actually helps him, though it also goes to Tam's point, as anybody else running in any state, whether it's purple or red, you've got to stick with Trump or suffer the consequences.
Yeah, that's the signal, is you've got to stay in line.
Well, while we're talking about Senate races, Amy, you wrote a piece for Cook Political Report where I got to say the headline tells it all. Senate Democrats are running strong. Why Senate Democrats are running strong even as Biden is struggling? We know the 2024 Senate map favors Republicans. Why are Democrats outperforming?
Yeah, they are doing better, not just in their overall approval ratings, which look stronger than Biden, but they're leading their Republican opponents. Now, some of that's just name identification because these are incumbents and nobody knows the challenger, Republican challengers as well. But some of it, too, is that they are actually getting a lot of those Democratic voters that Biden has yet to really solidify behind him. But also, they aren't getting dragged down by frustrations about the economy in the same way Biden is. And when I talked to a Republican strategist about this, his point was, that's right. So just making the case, as many Republicans would like to do, that, hey, Senate Democrat X, you should fire them because they're part of the Biden economy, that right now is not sticking. It may as we move forward. But what the argument of this strategist was, you've got to make a case for yourself still about how Republicans are going to make the economy better. So they've been able to get some distance from Biden on the economy. Republicans have not been able to get distance from Donald Trump with swing voters on some of the of his liabilities, especially on issues like abortion.
Meantime, Tam, we have some late-breaking news in that Senate Democrat Bob Menendez, who is facing, he's under indictment for corruption, he filed paperwork to run in New Jersey for the U.S. Senate as an independent. Tell us more about that and the potential impact.
Well, he wasn't going to win a Democratic primary, so there's that.
Yeah.
Being a declared candidate allows you to continue fundraising for your campaign, and your campaign fundraising could potentially help some of your other problems. That said, he doesn't appear to have a lot of staff, and the bigger challenge for Senate Democrats right now is that he's in a courtroom, and he's not in the Senate taking votes, and their numbers are so narrow that that actually does create some challenges for them.
And Amy, the local paper, the New Jersey Globe, reported that Menendez is managing his own race.
Yes.
And has no campaign staff, which
That's
suggests
right.
he's doing this based on name ID alone.
He's doing a name ID alone, and also to just keep being able to fundraise while he is on trial.
What does it mean for our politics, though?
Right. Well, you know, and what do people hear when they see that we have a member of the United States Senate who's in court, by the way, for a second time, on charges related to this bribery issue? I think for so many, and this is, I'm hoping this isn't the case, but I think a lot of people have this belief that the system itself is so corrupt, this is how most politicians act, it's just a matter of time, and that there was a time when the Department of Justice or the FBI looked at a member of Congress and said, we put you under the microscope, that the American public would say, we're going to stick with those in the establishment, we're going to believe them. Instead, now even the establishment, the institutions are not trusted.
Amy Walter and Tamara Keith, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Today, a special House subcommittee looking into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic pressed the man who helped lead the nation's response, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the former head of the National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Disease. William Brangham looks at some of the key criticisms leveled at Fauci's leadership during the pandemic and how he responded today.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
The man who was the face of America's COVID response, Dr. Anthony Fauci, returned to Capitol Hill today to publicly answer a barrage of accusations. First, that he used his influence as the head of one of the American government's biggest grant-giving organizations to dictate what researchers said publicly about how the pandemic began, about whether it jumped into humans from a wild animal being sold at a Chinese food market in Wuhan, or whether it came from an accidental leak out of the Chinese-run Wuhan Institute of Virology, which was researching coronaviruses.
The accusation being circulated that I influenced these scientists to change their minds by bribing them with millions of dollars in grant money is absolutely false and simply preposterous.
Fauci also faced questions about whether NIAID's passed grants to a virus researcher named Peter Daszak, who's president of the EcoHealth Alliance, was supporting research in China about how to make coronaviruses more contagious and virulent.
Failures stem from both
Representative Ronny Jackson, Republican of Texas, accused Fauci of funding the creation of the pandemic.
It was obvious to everyone that you and your organization, NIH, had a lot to lose if the American people were to discover that COVID-19 was most likely leaked from a lab in Wuhan, China, and that you, via EcoHealth Alliance and Peter Daszak, actually funded this research.
But during supportive questioning from Democrats, including Representative Raul Ruiz of California, Fauci said NIAID did not fund that kind of risky research and said that the viruses Daszak was studying couldn't have been responsible for what became SARS-CoV-2.
Those viruses were phylogenetically so far removed from SARS-CoV-2 that it is molecularly impossible for those viruses to have evolved or being made into SARS-CoV-2. It's just a virological fact.
But 2 weeks ago, under pressure from House Republicans, the Biden administration announced it would suspend grants to Daszak's organization, alleging it had failed to adequately monitor and report on its work in Wuhan.
A personal email.
Later in the day, Fauci did acknowledge, under repeated pressure from lawmakers like Representative James Comer of Kentucky, that one of his senior advisors, David Morans, violated numerous policies by using private email and altering documents.
Office.
Representative Jackson also pointed to an email where Morans said Fauci, referred to here as Tony, also used private email to skirt disclosure laws.
Dr. Morans wrote to Dr. Daszak in April of 2021, quote, P.S. I forgot to say there is no worry about FOIAs. I can either send stuff to Tony on his private email or hand it to him to work or at his house. He is too smart to let colleagues send him stuff that could cause trouble.
Fauci said he didn't know why Morans wrote that and insisted he never discussed COVID policy using his private email. At other times today, Fauci also faced criticism for promoting various public health measures. Republican Brad Wenstrup of Ohio is chairman of the committee.
Dr. Fauci, you oversaw one of the most invasive regimes of domestic policy the U.S. has ever seen, including mask mandates, school closures, coerced vaccination, social distancing of 6 feet, and more.
In previous testimony, Fauci said the CDC's initial guidance on maintaining 6 feet of distance wasn't, quote, based in science, but based on earlier understanding of how far viral droplets could travel through the air. He tried to clarify that statement today.
Well, when I say was not based in science, I meant a prospective clinical trial to determine whether 6 foot was better than 3, was better than 10.
But once we realized that the virus was not spread by droplets and was aerosolized, right, did you feel an indication to go back to the CDC and said, let's base this on science?
Children all over America were forced to wear masks.
Fauci also faced a fierce attack from Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene. She was later admonished by her chairman.
We should be writing a criminal referral because you should be prosecuted for crimes against humanity. You belong in prison, Dr. Fauci.
Earlier in the hearing, Fauci seemed to get choked up, describing how those kinds of accusations often led to violent threats.
It is very troublesome to me. It is much more troublesome because they've involved my wife and my three daughters.
At these moments, how do you feel? Keep your mic on.
Terrible.
Do you continue to receive threats today?
Yes, I do. Every time someone gets up and says I'm responsible for the death of people throughout the world, the death threats go up.
Next week, former CDC Director Rochelle Walensky will testify before the same committee. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
An art show in Hudson, New York called Talking Pictures plays off the prolific career of Michael Lindsay Hogg. He was at the creation of some of the biggest music moments of the 1960s and 70s, and now famed film director Peter Jackson has remastered Lindsay Hogg's original Let It Be for release on Disney+. Special correspondent Christopher Booker takes a look at his multimedia career for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
But she's uneasy, which is the state a lot of people are in, which is being uneasy.
Well, he wouldn't call it a rule or a guide. Michael Lindsay Hogg's paintings do follow a theme.
I only paint people. I'll paint a circle. The circle will turn into a face and a couple lines will turn into a neck. And in some of my paintings, there might be some kind of issue between them which is not resolved.
In this instance, the interaction is happening on a canvas. But 84-year-old Lindsay Hogg has spent a great deal of his creative time working to understand what happens between people. At 24, he was a young director in England, part of the groundbreaking music television show Ready, Steady, Go.
And here are the animals.
From 1963 to 1966, the Friday evening broadcast was the destination for the new breed of rock and roll.
You know, how lucky can you be that then when you turn up and you're starting to direct music, television, and subsequently videos, that it's that you're in the same generation as the Who, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, the Yardbirds, the Kinks.
But it wasn't just luck. His directorial abilities captured the attention of those leading this burgeoning social and musical revolution. In 1966, the Beatles hired him to direct videos for their songs Rain and Paperback Writer, followed shortly thereafter by the Rolling Stones.
When I first met them, there were no videos. The music shows, certainly in England and America, sort of controlled who was going to be on the show, and they wanted the performers on their show. In England, only the Beatles and the Rolling Stones had the power to be able to say, it's too much of a hassle for us to show up. And also, they wanted the control of the images. So we're going to give you videos.
In the fall of 1968, he would help conceive and direct the Rolling Stones' Rock and Roll Circus. Just 1 month after the circus, he was hired by the Beatles to document the writing and recording of a new album, the sessions that would produce Let It Be.
I remember it was Christmas, and I was going to have it with my girlfriend, and I was thinking, how lucky can you be? I just finished shooting the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus in mid-December 68, and in early 1969, I'm going to start working on a concert film with the Beatles. How lucky can you be?
While Lindsay Hogg credits luck and circumstance for putting him in this position, both of these projects would fall victim to events outside of his control. Release of the Rock and Roll Circus was delayed, and the tapes later lost, the film not seeing the light of day until 1996. Let It Be was another story entirely.
Rehearsing, recording, rapping, relaxing.
It was part of the collateral damage. People thought it was the breakup movie. It was released 1 month after the Beatles broke up.
The film Let It Be received brutal reviews and has largely been shelved since the early 1980s. And Lindsay Hogg says his reputation took a hit.
My stock got lower after it came out and the Beatles kind of shunned it. So I began to remake my career. And then gradually, I started to do better work.
Creatively, how did you weather that?
Well, I know. It's kind of like it's kind of like the airplane, which gets bumpy for a while, you know. You hope it lands at an airport that you can get off at and start and do something else.
Lindsay Hogg's Something Else included more music videos, concert films, television, theater, movies, and later a memoir. And for the past three decades, there's also been painting. But history has been in the midst of a revision in the way it considers his work with the Beatles, particularly with the help of Peter Jackson, the New Zealand director behind the Oscar-winning Lord of the Rings franchise, who spent nearly 4 years sifting through 57 hours of Lindsay Hogg's original Beatles footage to release the three-part, six-hour film, Get Back.
When we first met, he said, tell me the story of Let It Be. Why do I have all this footage? And then I told him about what had happened. And he said, so if you weren't involved, Let It Be would really have been an orphan. And I'd never heard of anyone use that word for this movie because it was an orphan. is I've always been trying to protect it. It's a very, very affectionate picture. It's basically a story about four men who loved each other and had loved each other since they were in their teens, who'd had the most extraordinary early youth together when the world blew up and showered them with all the glories of the world, but who now were aiming toward their 30s. And they had different expectations, different ambitions, and it's really about how they were making that transition, which is what I hope people will see when it comes out again.
But revisiting this past work is for later. Right now, his focus is on painting.
I know there is a conversation going on, like in this one. One of the things I think is interesting about painting is you're trying to create order, because life is disordered. Life is chaotic, and you do your best to deal with all that. So therefore, you're trying to create with color and design some kind of order and completion to it. And it's not random.
I know it wasn't this way, but the chronology seems clean and clear.
I'm lucky because I've always been able to do what interests me. I mean, there have been bad moments, of course, and failure and disaster and humiliation and everything. But I just think, you know, let it all go. This is what makes me who I am for good or bad. And then you have to accept who you are for good or bad.
Through the spring, the Hudson Hall will host his latest collection entitled Talking Pictures. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Christopher Booker in Hudson, New York.
And we'll be back shortly with a look at a first-of-its-kind medical school for Native American doctors. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station.
It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air.
For those stations staying with us, our conversation with comedian Atsuko Okatsuka, who taps into her tumultuous life story for laughs. Born in Taiwan to Japanese and Taiwanese parents, Okatsuka eventually moved to the U.S. and lived undocumented for 7 years. In this Encore report, I sat down with Okatsuka to talk about the growing audience for her unique brand of comedy. The conversation was part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Her comedy is physical.
Did you eat? No. Eat, please. Eat, 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 eat.
Her style eccentric.
Wow, it's Otto. It's the weird one. Oh, shit's gonna get weird and crazy.
And she knows how to hook her audience.
Bye bye. See don't go.
Atsuko Okatsuka is an internet sensation with followers who watch as she marries her husband for the second time.
The streets got married again.
Come on!
And dances with her grandmother, who now has a separate fan base of her own. Okatsuka rocketed to viral fame with the creation of her own drop challenge to a Beyoncé song. A million people watched her, creating their own videos, including tennis star Serena Williams and actor Mandy Moore.
My husband and I had an intruder come to our house.
And she shines in her first HBO comedy special, The Intruder.
The guy kind of watches this, freaks out, and starts to run away.
Her quirky observational humor has struck a chord.
Truly, there is a corner in my house that I sometimes take the time to stand at just because I pay rent. Yeah, I'm always like, this is like $30 right here. Why don't I ever stand here? You pay for it. At least feel it.
She sat down with me recently and talked about discovering comedy in an unlikely place.
When I first watched stand-up comedy was through Margaret Cho. So it was this DVD that was handed to me during a really, really boring sermon at church. You know, one of my friends was like passed it to me and was like, shh, hey, this is stand-up comedy. And it was someone who looked like me. And then it wouldn't be till years later that A boyfriend told me that I was funny and that I should try doing stand-up.
Yes, my fellow basic person.
It also took years to get her own special. Okatsuka is just the second Asian-American woman ever to get her own HBO comedy special. The first was Margaret Cho over two decades ago.
I never saw Asian people on television or in movies, so my dreams were somewhat limited. I would dream, maybe someday I could be an extra on MASH.
I think people are afraid of things not working, you know? People are afraid of things they're not used to seeing. But they have to trust the audience. The audience has been asking for it. And that's what I mean by like social media and like as stand-up comedians can post their own clips online and then they, you know, gain their own followers and go on tour and the audience is there and they prove like, look, people do want to see this, you know, then the industry usually listens.
You have a story a lot of people can relate to though about coming here, learning how to fit in, making a new life in a new country, and your comedy special is called The Intruder. Is there another meaning behind that title too?
Yeah, and I'm glad that like you saw it because it's not so over the head, right? But yeah, the double entendre is that, you know, as a formerly undocumented immigrant, right, I oftentimes felt like I was intruding, you know, on everyone else.
What do you mean by that?
I'm coming to someone else's country, I'm coming to someone else's culture, and, you know, being without papers means like, you're not really supposed to be here. Anybody who's ever felt like an outsider, just because you talk differently or, you know, look differently or dress differently than other people, than the norm, you know, I think you might have felt like an intruder as well.
I am a product of divorced parents.
What about your family and how you came to live in the U.S.?
My mom and grandma and I moved to the U.S. when I was 8. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I didn't know I was moving here. You know, my grandma, she's so sweet, unassuming looking, you know, this like old Asian woman, you know, but she was a liar, you know. She told me we were coming to the States for a 2-month vacation. And then she had us oversee our tourist visas. We became undocumented. We were living in my uncle's garage. And so that's how she at least got me to move to LA.
My dad's on his third divorce. My mom's schizophrenic. At a certain point, you know, I want to look at my family and be like, guys, if you wanted me to do comedy, you could have just told me. You know what I mean? Truly.
Talked about your mother's own mental illness. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important to weave those details into your work?
As a kid, I was always able to make sad things funny. Not just for me, but for my family. It's just a part of how I communicate with people. You know, I go, okay, this very difficult to talk about subject, mental illness, no worries, let's talk about it. But I'm gonna make you laugh while I'm doing it, you know? And that way, like, we both feel better. Yeah.
Okatsuka continues to tour across the country, bringing her comedy and building connections wherever she goes.
What do you love about this work? What is it like when you're up on stage and you can make an entire room laugh?
Oh gosh, it's finding community. Yeah. And my fans are fellow weirdos. You know, you're a fellow weirdo for even connecting with me.
Thank you for that.
Watching my comedy, even laughing at it. Sorry, you're not normal. And that's what I love, though, that we can all find each other and be like, yes, like, we're not alone. In all the times we might have felt that way. That's why I love it.
A first-of-its-kind medical school located in the Cherokee Nation recently graduated its inaugural class. Our Oklahoma Communities correspondent, Adam Kemp, shares how the program was started and why the need for these doctors is so great.
A ceremony celebrating a historic first. In the days leading up to graduation, representatives from 5 different Native American tribes in Oklahoma honored its newest generation of doctors.
It matters to you whether we've got graduates like the ones we're celebrating today. And if you're Native American, or if you're a tribal leader, if you're a tribal citizen, It's of particular importance to you.
The students are part of Oklahoma State University's College of Osteopathic Medicine at the Cherokee Nation, the first ever physician training program on a Native American reservation. The curriculum offers students firsthand experience serving Native communities and understanding their specific healthcare needs.
Once I actually got to see and work with patients from my tribe, I really just fell in love with it. These last few years, being at a Native medical school, the first in the country, it's been amazing.
Graduate Caitlin Cosby is a citizen of the Choctaw Nation. She is among the one-fifth of Native American students that make up the inaugural class.
The, you know, Cherokee Nation campus was a really big deal for me. I've always wanted to be able to serve my people ever since I was able to actually live in the area where a lot of, you know, the culture is.
For Mackenzie Thompson, another graduate and member of the Choctaw Nation, the program not only provided a medical education, but also brought her closer to her own heritage.
And I wasn't really raised traditionally Choctaw. Some of those like traditions were kind of lost in my family lineage. And so coming here, I've been able to connect with other Choctaw students and learn about our heritage, but then also just learn so much about the Cherokee Nation and their culture.
OSU partnered with the Cherokee Nation to open the school in 2020 to help erase the shortage of indigenous doctors nationwide, who, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges, make up only 0.3% of physicians.
People want to see someone that looks like them and is from their culture, and to me that's really important for representation.
Students also specialize in treating rural communities, which, like Native ones, face higher than average provider shortages and worse overall health outcomes. As future doctors of osteopathic medicine, OSU graduates receive similar training as traditional medical doctors, but with a focus on holistic health and prevention.
Just having that holistic kind of mindset when we approach medicine is something that I feel like pairs really well with the Native American philosophies of medicine.
Next up for graduates is residency. Thompson herself will continue serving the indigenous community in the Cherokee Nation's capital of Tahlequah.
It just makes me super excited to go to a tribal residency and just get to continue to learn more about my Native culture and how to take care of my people best, and yeah, and give back for the rest of my career.
I hope that my journey will be able to inspire other young Native, kids to be able to do this, because I think it's important to see someone do it because you know you can do it. And, I would love to see more, and I'm really proud to be Choctaw, and I'm really proud to be from the OSU Cherokee Nation campus.
These graduates are the first in what OSU hopes to be a new wave of doctors closing healthcare gaps for Native communities. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Adam Kemp.
And join us again here tomorrow night for a look at why some universities are returning to using standardized testing in their admissions process. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by
Cunard is a proud supporter of public television. On a voyage with Cunard, the world awaits. A world of flavor, diverse destinations, and immersive experiences. A world of leisure and British style. All with Cunard's White Star service.
Supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions. This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
right. We're on a direct course to Marketplace that's starting in a few minutes at the top of the hour at 4 o'clock. Natalia Navarro will be in with KQED News. Right now, Julie Depesch is here, and we're off to the Altamont Pass.
It looks like they've got a handle on that car fire eastbound 580 at the Stonecut overpass. That right lane still taken away. We're seeing major delays into Dublin. So a big crash San Jose involving three vehicles eastbound 237 before Zanker. At least one lane blocked here. It's solid from Lawrence Expressway. And San Lorenzo, a three-car pileup on southbound 880 at the 238 split. It's in the two left lanes. That's backing up into Oakland. Julie Depesch for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health in the North Bay to deliver exceptional orthopedic care, including surgical and non-surgical options for spine conditions. UCSFHealth.org/MarinHealth. The Asian Art Museum, Phoenix Kingdoms, the last splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at asianart.org.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Tracy residents are trying to find some sense of normalcy after the Corral fire tore through the area over the weekend. KQED's Aaron Baldessari spoke to a few of them.
On Saturday, Lucille Holloway saw the sky go dark and smoke fill the air. She dropped everything to evacuate and wait out the fire at a friend's house. Her home wasn't damaged, but she's still reeling from the shock.
It's just trying to, I call it, come down.
Today, she went out to grab some milk, a small step toward normal.
Go in, you're going to put it away. These are big steps right now, but it's true. That's how you feel.
A patch of grass on her front lawn is burned, a reminder of how close the fire came.
You realize how close somebody